Hello. Before we begin, a quick note. The Boy to Sleep podcast relies on you and sponsors, which means you will hear a quick advertisement before the beginning of tonight's episode. While the podcast is free, you are welcome to subscribe for just $2.99 per month, which supports the creation of this podcast and gives you an ad-free listening experience. Simply click the link in the show notes from your podcast app. Rest easy.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello. Welcome to the Bore You to Sleep podcast. The podcast that will hopefully help you get to sleep. I am going to read an open source book, one that is not particularly interesting, but one that is hopefully boring enough to get you to sleep. Tonight's reading comes from The Outermost House, A Year of Life on the Great Beach of Cape Cod, written by Henry Beston and published in 1929. This story looks at the magical year that the author spent in Cape Cod. My name is Teddy, and I am to help people everywhere get a good night's rest. Sleep is so important, and my mission is to help you get the rest that you need. The podcast is designed to play in the background while you slowly fall asleep. For those of you who don't know, this podcast was created because I had my own issues with sleep. I wanted to bring another resource to people out there who may have also had similar issues that I had. The podcast is self-made and self-produced, which is why you'll hear a quick ad at the beginning of each episode. With the help of subscribers and Patreon sponsors, I am able to keep delivering this podcast for free to those who need it. Thank you to everybody who shared their words of gratitude with me during the week, whether it be through the website or your podcast app. Firstly, a big thank you to new Patreon sponsor, Miriam. Your support is a true compliment, and I'm glad to have you as part of the Boy to Sleep community. A massive thank you to the new subscribers via Spotify for Podcasters, and thank you to all existing subscribers and Patreon sponsors. Thank you to listeners who reached out via the website. Thank you, Chad, for your lovely message. And thank you, Susie Thompson, for your extremely thoughtful message. I'm glad to hear that you're getting the sleep that you deserve. And thank you also to Laura for subscribing to the podcast and reaching out via the website. Thank you to iTunes listener Ruby Rainbow from Canada. I'm so glad the podcast is boring enough to help you sleep. Thank you to all of the Spotify listeners who took the time to leave a response in the episode Q&A. Your responses in Spotify are very helpful, which is why I publish them right away to say thank you. If you find the podcast beneficial and would like to support the podcast in some way, there are a few ways you can contribute. Be sure, of course, to follow the podcast in your podcast app. And of course, you are welcome to become a subscriber for $2.99 per month. This will ensure that you remove any Spotify ads at the beginning of each episode. If that is not possible, then an easy way to support the podcast is simply by following it and leaving a review and rating in your podcast app. Even one sentence really helps out. If you would like, you can always say hello to me at boytosleep.com, which is a great way to allow me to receive your message and also reply. I love hearing from listeners. It lets me know that I am bringing value to their world and allowing them to get a good night's rest. A fantastic way to say thank you and to help someone else is to share the podcast with a friend who may need it. These are fantastic ways for me to help others and is one of the greatest compliments I can receive. In the meantime, lie back, relax, and enjoy the readings. The Outermost House. A Year of Life on the Great Beach of Cape Cod. By Henry Beston. Forward. Only a solitary knows how social and kindly life can be. While living on the beach, I was helped by so many friends and Cape Cod neighbors that I should be writing a chapter were I to try to list them all. There are a few, however, to whom I owe more than neighborly gratitude. To my friends Prince and Edna Nickerson, Heard of Eastham, to Mrs. Mercy A. Mines, and to Mr. John Nickerson, I owe both my right to build on the Duneland, and a world of kindest aid. For my chance to live this book and write it, I would here thank them first of all. I owe another real debt to Harvey Moore for building me so strong and snug a little house. Another to George and Mary Smith for their hospitality, good counsel, and encouragement. Another to Nate and Helen Clark. And I should like to thank Captain George Nickerson of Norset Station, Bosun's mate Charles Ellis, the present number one, and the rest of the Norset crew for the 1,000 kind and friendly things they did to help me. The majority of my illustrations I owe to the courtesy of my Quincy friend and neighbour, the Honourable William A. Bradford. Mr. Bradford made several special trips to the Cape to get the pictures, and spared no time or effort in preparing them for the book. I would here most gratefully acknowledge this kindness. I wish to return thanks to Mr. Alva Morrison for his fine studies of the winter beach and for his notes on birds, to Mr. Arthur Cleveland Bent for the use of the 2 rare photographs from his collection, to Dr. A.B. Clue for the sandpiper illustration, to Commander Donald McMillan and the American Museum of Natural History for the dovekies, to Dr. John E. Fish for his photograph of the summer standing, to Mr. George A. Whiting of Eastham for his distinguished studies of the beach and the Montclair, and to Mr. Robert Whiting for his striking photograph of the fishing schooner in the surf at Pamet. And I wish to thank Mr. John Farrar with all my heart for the patience and goodwill with which he has dealt with so inaccessible an observer as myself. I have made several references to Mr. E. H. Forbush's Birds of Massachusetts and Surrounding States. This compendium is a favourite of mine, for it is the work of one who is both a literary artist as well as a distinguished ornithologist. I wish to record as well an obligation to the staffs of the various state and federal bureaus which I have consulted, and I would thank the Honourable A. Piat Andrew of the 6th Massachusetts for the unfailing courtesy and goodwill with which he responded to my frequent requests for scientific studies published at Washington. My narrative concerns itself with the events of a 12-month, though I spent on and off a somewhat longer time upon the beach. There was a season in the spring when I had to leave the house a while. I would close with the acknowledgement of a special and very great obligation, my debt to Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Kelly of the Overlook Inn in Eastham. Without their constant and ever thoughtful aid, without their hospitable roof to turn to on occasion, without their friendly care for my interests ashore, it would have been perhaps impossible to remain upon the beach. With heartfelt gratitude do I thank them here. Long may their hospitable doors stand open on Cape Cod. Quincy, Massachusetts. The Outermost House, Chapter 1. The Beach. East and ahead of the coast of North America, some 30 miles and more from the inner shores of Massachusetts, there stands in the open Atlantic the last fragment of an ancient and vanished land. For 20 miles this last and outer earth faces the ever-hostile ocean in the form of a great eroded cliff of earth and clay. Worn by the breakers and the rains, disintegrated by the wind, it still stands bold. Many earths compose it, and many gravels and sands stratified and intermingled. It has many colours, old ivory here, peat here, and here old ivory darkened and enriched with rust. At twilight, its rim lifted to the splendour in the west, the face of the wall becomes a substance of shadow and dark descending to the eternal unquiet of the sea. At dawn, the sun rising out of the ocean gilds it with a level silence of light which thins and rises and vanishes into day. At the foot of this cliff, a great ocean beach runs north and south unbroken, mile lengthening into mile, solitary and elemental, unsullied and remote, visited and possessed by the outer sea. These sands might be the end or the beginning of a world. Age by age, the sea here gives battle to the land. Age by age, the earth struggles for her own, calling to her defense her energies and her creations, bidding her plants steal down upon the beach, and holding the frontier sands in a net of grass and roots which the storm washes free. The great rhythms of nature, today so dully disregarded, wounded even, have here their spacious and primeval liberty. Cloud and shadow of cloud, wind and tide, tremor of night and day. Journeying birds alight here and fly away again all unseen. Schools of great fish move beneath the waves. The surf flings its spray against the sun. Often spoken of as being entirely glacial, this bulwark is really an old land surfaced with a new. The seas broke upon the same ancient bounds long before the ice had gathered or the sun had fogged and cooled. There was once, so it would seem, a northern coastal plain. This crumbled at its rim, time and catastrophe changed its level and its form, and the sea came inland over it through the years. Its last enduring frontier roughly corresponds to the wasted front of the cliff. Moving down into the sea, later glaciations passed over the old beaches and the fragments of the plain, and stumbling over them, heaped upon these sills, their accumulated drift of gravels, sand and stones. The warmer sea and time prevailing, the ice cliff retreated westward through its fogs, and presently the waves coursed onto a new, a transformed and lifeless land. So runs as far as it is possible to reconstruct it in general terms. The geological history of Cape Cod. The east and west arm of the peninsula is a buried area of the ancient plain, the forearm, the glaciated fragment of a coast. The peninsula stands farther out to sea than any other portion of the Atlantic coast of the United States. It is the outermost of outer shores. Thundering in against the cliff, the ocean here encounters the last defiant bulwark of two worlds. The cliff I ride of and the bordering beach face the Atlantic on the forearm of the Cape. This outer earth is now scarce more than a great dike or wall some 25 miles long, and only 3 and 4 miles wide. At Provincetown it rises from the sea, beginning there in a desert of dunes and sand plains of the ocean's making. These sands curve inland toward the continent, bending toward Plymouth even as a hand may be bent down at the wrist, and Provincetown Harbour lies in the curve of palm and fingers. At Truro, the wrist of the Cape, the forearm simile being both exact and inescapable, the land curve falls from the east and west down through an arc to the north and south, and the earth cliff begins and rises rather suddenly to its greatest elevation. South by east from the Highland Light to Eastham and Norset Coast Guard Station, the rampart fronts the sea, its skyline being now a progress of long undulations, now a level as military as a battlement hollows and mounded hills here, and there revealing the barren moorland character of the country just above. At Norset, the cliff ends, the sea invades the narrowing land, and one enters the kingdom of the dunes. The cliff ends, and a wall of ocean dunes carries on the beach. 5 miles long, this wall ends at a channel over whose entrance shoals the ocean sweeps daily into a great inlet or lagoon back of the dunes, an inlet spaced with the floors of tidal islands and traced with winding creeks. The inlet of Eastham and Orleans. Very high tides covering the islands sometimes turn this space into bay. Westward, over the channels and the marshland, one looks to the uplands of the Cape, here scarce a good 2 miles wide. At Eastham, the land is an open, rolling moor. West over this lies Cape Cod Bay, a powerful tribe of Indians, the Norsets, once inhabited this earth between the seas. Outermost cliff and solitary dune, the plain of ocean and the far, bright rims of the world, meadow land and marsh and ancient moor, this is Eastham. This, the outer Cape. Sun and moon rise here from the sea. The arched sky has an ocean vastness. The clouds are now of ocean, now of earth. Having known and loved this land for many years, it came about that I found myself free to visit there, and so I built myself a house upon the beach. My house stood by itself atop a dune, a little less than halfway south on Eastern Bar. I drew the homemade plans for it myself, and it was built for me by a neighbor and his carpenters. When I began to build, I had no notion whatever of using the house as a dwelling place. I simply wanted a place to come to in the summer, one cozy enough to be visited in winter, could I manage to get down. I called it the faux castle. It consisted of two rooms, a bedroom and a kitchen living room, and its dimensions overall were but 20 by 16. A brick fireplace with its back to the wall between the rooms heated the larger space and took the chill off the bedroom. And I used a two-burner oil stove when cooking. My neighbor built well. The house, even as I hoped, proved compact and strong, and it was easy to run and easy to heat. The larger room was sheathed, and I painted the wainscoting and the window frames a kind of buff fawn, a good forecastle colour. The house showed perhaps a somewhat amateur enthusiasm for windows. I had 10. In my larger room I had 7. A pair to the east opening on the sea, a pair to the west commanding the marshes, a pair to the south, and a small lock sea in the door. 7 windows in one room perched on a hill of sand under an ocean sun. The words suggest cross lights and a glare, a fair misgiving, and one I encountered by the use of wooden shutters originally meant for winter service, but found necessary through the year. By arranging these, I found I could have either the most sheltered and darkened of rooms, or something rather like an inside out of doors. In my bedroom I had 3 windows, one east, one west, and one north to Norset Light. To get drinking water, I drove a well pipe directly down into the dune, though the sea and the beach are alongside, and the marsh channels course daily to the west. There is fresh water here under the salty sand. This water varies in quality, some of it being brackish, some of it sweet and clear. To my great delight, I chanced upon a source which seems to me as good as water as one may find here anywhere. Beneath the floor, the pipe descended into a bricked up and covered pit, housing a petcock through which I drained the water from the pump in freezing weather. On bitter days I simply pumped a few pails full and stood them in the sink, and drained the pump immediately. I had 2 oil lamps and various bottle candlesticks to read by, and a fireplace crammed more full of driftwood to keep me warm. I have no doubt that the fireplace heating arrangement sounds wrong, but it worked, and my fire was more than a source of heat. It was an elemental presence, a household of God and a friend. In my larger room, I had a chest of drawers painted an honest carriage blue, a table, a wall bookcase, a couch, 2 chairs and a rocker. My kitchen built yacht, fashion all in a line, stood at the southern wall. First came a dish and crockery cupboard, then a space for the oil stove. I kept this boxed in when not in use. Then a shelf, a porcelain sink, and the corner pump. Blessed pump. It never failed me or indulged in nerves. Using a knapsack, I carried my supplies on my own shoulders. There is no road through the dunes, and even if there were, no one would have made deliveries. West of the dunes, it is true, there exists a kind of trail on which fords may venture, but even the most experienced of the villagers are wary of it, and tell of being mired there or stuck in the sand. Nevertheless, my lumber came by this trail, and now and then I could get my oil cans carried down by a neighbour who had a horse and cart. These helps, however, were but occasional, and I counted myself fortunate to have had them at all. My knapsack remained the only ever-ready wagon of the dunes. Twice a week, by arrangement, a friend met me at Nauset Station with a car, took me shopping to Eastham or Orleans, and brought me back again to Nauset. And there I would pack my milk and eggs and butter and rolls, being very careful as to which was sitting on which, and strike off down the beach along the breakers. The top of the mound I built on stands scarce 20 feet above high water mark, and only 30 in from the great beach. The coast guards at Nauset, a scant 2 miles away, were my only neighbours. South lay the farther dunes, and a few far away and lonely gunning camps. The floor of marsh and tide parted me on the west from the village and its distant cottages. The ocean besieged my door. North and north alone had I touch with human things. On its solitary dune, my house faced the four walls of the world. My house completed and tried and not found wanting by a first Cape Cod year. I went there to spend a fortnight in September. The fortnight ending, I lingered on. But as the year lengthened into autumn, the beauty and mystery of this earth and outer sea so possessed and held me that I could not go. The world today is sick to its thin blood for lack of elemental things, for fire before the hands, for water welling from the earth, for air, for the dear earth itself underfoot. In my world of beach and dune, these elemental presences lived and had their being, and under their arch there moved an incomparable pageant of nature and the year. The flux and reflux of ocean, the incomings of waves, the gatherings of birds, the pilgrimages of the people of the sea, winter and storm, the splendor of autumn, and the holiness of spring. All these were part of the great beach. The longer I stayed, the more eager was I to know this coast, and to share its mysterious and elemental life. I found myself free to do so. I had no fear of being alone. I had something of a field naturalist's inclination. Presently I made up my mind to remain and try living for a year on Eastham Beach. The sandbar of Eastham is the sea wall of this inlet. Its crest overhangs the beach, and from the high, wind-trampled rim, a long slope, well overgrown with dune grass, descends to the meadows on the west. Seen from the tower at Nauset, the land has an air of geographical simplicity. As a matter of fact, it is full of hollows, blind passages and amphitheatres in which the roaring of the sea changes into the far roar of the cataract. I often wander into these curious pits. On their floors of sand, on their slopes, I find patterns made by the fleet of visiting birds. Here in little disturbed and claw-marked space of sand, a flock of larks has alighted. Here one of the birds has wandered off by himself. Here are the deeper tracks of hungry crows. Here the webbed impressions of a gull. There is always something poetic and mysterious to me about these tracks in the pits of the dunes. They begin at nowhere, sometimes with the faint impression of an alighting wing, and vanishes suddenly into the trackless nowhere of the sky. Below the eastern rim, the dunes fall in steeps of sand to the beach. Walking the beach close and along these steeps, one walks in the afternoon shade of a kind of sand escarpment, now 7 or 8 feet high and reasonably level, now 15 or 20 feet high to the top of a dome or mound. In 4 or 5 places, storms have washed gullies or cuts clean through the wall. Dune plants grow in these dry beds, rooting themselves in under old, half-buried wreckage. Clumps of dusty miller, Artemisia stelleriana, being the most familiar green. The plant flourishes in the most exposed situations. It jumps from the dune rim to the naked slopes. It even tries to find a permanent station on the beach. Silvery grey green all summer long. In autumn, it puts on golden russet golden colourings of singular delicacy and beauty. The grass grows thickest on the slopes and shoulders of the mounds, its tall leaves enclosing intrusive heads and clumps of the thick-fleshed dune goldenrod. Still lower down the slope, where the sands open and the spears rise thin, the beech pea catches the eye with its familiar leaf and faded topmost bloom. Lower still, on desert-like floors, are tussock mats of poverty grass and the flat green stars of innumerable spurges. The only real bushes of the region are beech plum thickets, and these are few and far between. All these plants have enormously long taproots which bury themselves deep in the moist core of the sands. The greater part of the year I have 2 beaches, one above, one below. The lower or tidal beach begins at mean low water and climbs a clean slope to the high water mark of the average low course tide. The upper beach, more of a plateau in form, occupies the space between high water and the dunes. The width of these beaches changes with every storm and every tide, but I shall not be far out if I call them both an average 75 feet wide. Unseasonable storm tides and high course tides make of the beach one vast new floor. Winter tides narrow the winter's upper beach and often sweep across it to the dunes. The whole beach builds up in summer, and if each tide pushed more and more sand against it out of the sea, perhaps currents wash in sand from the outer bars. It is no easy task to find a name or a phrase for the colour of Eastern sand. Its tone, moreover, varies with the hour and the seasons. One friend says yellow on its way to brown. Another speaks of the colour of raw silk. Whatever colour images these hints may offer to a reader's mind, the colour of the sand here on a June day is as warm and rich a tone as one may find. Late in the afternoon, there descends upon the beach and the bordering sea a delicate overtone of faintest violet. There is no harshness here in the landscape line, no hard northern brightness or brusque revelation. There is always reserve and mystery, always something beyond, on earth and sea, something which nature, honouring, conceals. The sand here has a life of its own, even if it is only a life borrowed from the wind. One pleasant summer afternoon, while a high gusty westerly was blowing, I saw a little wind devil, a miniature tornado 6 feet high, rush at full speed out of a cart, whirl itself full of sand upon the beach and spin off breakwood. As it crossed the beach, the devil caught the sun, and there burst out of the sand smoke a brownish prism of burning, spinning, and fantastic colour. South of me, the dune I call Big Dune, now and then goes through a curious performance. Seen lengthwise, the giant has the shape of a wave, its slope to the beach being a magnificent fan of purest wind-blown sand, its westward slope a descent to a sandy amphitheatre. During a recent winter, a Coast Guard key post was erected on the peak of the dune. The feet of the night patrols trod down and nicked the crest. And presently, this insignificant notch began to work and to deepen. It is now 8 or 9 feet wide and as many deep. From across the marshes, it might be a kind of great, roundish bite out of the crest. On windy autumn days, when the sand is still dry and alive, and westerly gusts and currents take on a genuine violence, the loose sand behind the dune is whirled up by the wind and poured eastward through this funnel. At such times, the peak smokes like a volcano. The smoke is now a steaming blackish plume, now a thin old ivory wrath, and it billows, eddies, and pours out from a sea Vesuvius. Between the dunes and the marshes, an irregular width of salt hay land extends from the sand slopes to the marshier widths of tidal land along the creeks. Each region has its own grasses, the meadows being almost a patchwork of competing growths. In the late summer and the autumn, the marsh lavender, thin strewn but straying everywhere, lifts its cloud of tiny sun-faded flowers above the tawny, almost deer-coloured grasses. The marsh islands beyond are but great masses of thatch grass rising from floors of sodded mud and sand. There are hidden pools in these unvisited acres, which only sunset reveals. The wild ducks know them well, and take refuge in them when stalked by gunners. How singular is it that so little has been written about the birds of Cape Cod? The peninsula, from an ornithologist's point of view, is one of the most interesting in the world. The interest does not center on the resident birds, for they are no more numerous here than they are in various other pleasant places. It lies in the fact that living here, one may see more kinds and varieties of birds than it would seem possible to discover in any one small region. At Eastham, for instance, among visitors and migrants, residents and casuals, I had land birds and moor birds, marsh birds and beach birds, sea birds and coastal birds, even birds of the outer ocean. West Indian hurricanes, moreover, often catch up and fling ashore here curious tropical and semi-tropical forms. A glossy ibis in one storm, a frigate bird in another. And that concludes tonight's reading. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this story. If you're not quite tired yet, please feel free to listen to another episode of the Boy to Sleep podcast. Until next time, and good night.